From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new report finds the worst economic divide in the nation is the one between Detroit and Grosse Pointe schools. The head of Grosse Pointe's NAACP cries foul.
But this is nothing more than a thinly veiled attempt to advance the charter school movement at the expense of African Americans.
Is the steam running out of our recovery from the Great Recession? Local leaders all over Michigan are more worried about their fiscal health.
If these kind of problems can start to happen while the economy is improving, what's going to happen when our next recession hits?
How Michigan's fight over straight ticket voting could affect races for the State Board of Education and the governing bodies at U of M, MSU, and Wayne State.
Most of those people split their tickets never finished their ballot. They never voted for education races.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new report finds the education divide along the border of Grosse Pointe and Detroit is the very worst in the nation. Plus, what is causing the rashes and hair loss among people in Flint? A new report looks at that. But first, when you go to vote this fall, it's your chance to weigh in on education. Amidst mounting calls for the state to do a better job educating its students, you'll get the chance to vote on a State Board of Education and the trustees or Board of Governors of Michigan's three big public universities. Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry is with us now. Jack, in past elections, those education races were kind of overlooked, but you think this year could be different? Why is that?
Well, that's true. In past years, they pretty much followed the way the top of the ticket has gone, but this year could be a little different, Cindy, primarily because of the issue involving transgender students. And President Obama issued a presidential directive that schools should allow transgender students to use whatever bathroom and maybe even locker rooms they were most comfortable with. There's a lot of pushback on that. John Austin, a Democrat who's been on the board 16 years and is the president of the State Board of Education, is very supportive of that. He wants the board to issue policy about that. It'd be just an advisory policy. They don't have the clout to make school districts comply. But some conservatives are talking about maybe targeting Mr. Austin because of this.
And of course, as you say earlier this week, we've got this issue now with a federal judge in Texas blocking the Obama administration action, saying the federal law, Title IX, that bars public schools from discriminating on the basis of sex doesn't apply to transgender students, and also saying the federal government didn't seek public comment, which, of course, we should note the state board here in Michigan did. It got thousands of comments. What impact do you think that preliminary injunction from Texas may have on Michigan's transgender school bathroom question?
Not a lot, except it may embolden people to seek legal remedies here. What normally happens in cases like this is you have a bunch of contradictory rulings from various federal judges and federal appellate courts, and then the U.S. Supreme Court decides it. Oh, that may well take years. In this case, it's more a question of what's going to happen in the ballot box, but the Democrats and John Austin got some very good news earlier this month.
And what was that?
Well, the appellate court in Cincinnati has upheld a lower federal judge, Judge Gershwin Drain in Detroit, struck down a law. The Republicans passed a law last year that would end straight ticket voting in Michigan, and they wanted to do that for exclusively partisan reasons. More people vote straight ticket Democratic, usually, than Republican. In the western part of the state, it's more Republicans. But because you have more straight ticket Democrats, this is causing Democrats to win most or all of the education races most of the time. For example, 2 years ago, Governor Snyder got reelected, but Democrats won 8 out of the 9 State Board of Education races for this reason. A lot of people split their tickets. A lot of Republicans, independents voted for Snyder, but then they voted for Democratic Senator Gary Peters. Most of those people split their tickets never finished their ballot. They never voted for education races, whereas people in Detroit and Flint just voted straight ticket Democratic, and that saved most of the Democrats. Passing that law would have, if that law had held up, it would have hurt Democrats, but the federal judge struck it down, saying it was discriminatory towards African Americans.
Of course, we still know Attorney General Schuette's not done fighting that, and he has, put in this emergency appeal with the appeals court. So it's still in play.
It's still in play, but he's only got a few days.
Yeah.
Because it has to be done by September 9th, because these ballots have to be printed and mailed to overseas service people.
So if we are allowed straight ticket voting, I think I'm hearing you saying that Democratic candidates could be more successful.
Yes, especially since there is a wide presumption that Hillary Clinton will win the state of Michigan. Michigan has become a fairly reliable Democratic state. Most polls show her well ahead, maybe by 9 or 10%. And if she wins by that kind of margin, it's a pretty safe bet that all the Democrats will win for education races.
And as you say, John Austin being out in front of the transgender bathroom issue may mean he has a target on his back for conservatives. Who's the second nominee for the Democrats?
Well, they haven't completely determined that yet, but it's likely to be Ismail Ahmed. There's a former state representative named John Stewart who also would like it, but Ismail Ahmed is a very highly regarded gentleman who was a founder of Access, one of the most successful private welfare agencies in the country. He was an assistant provost at U of M Dearborn, and he's also a Muslim. And he's a rather secular Muslim. His wife is a Christian. But because of this, Mr. Ahmed was nominated 14 years ago to be a regent at the University of Michigan, and he was defeated in what was an otherwise fairly Democratic year. He was defeated specifically, I believe, because he was a Muslim, and it was only a year after 9/11. But he's well-regarded, but again, there may be some people who don't think there should be a Muslim on the State Board of Education.
And we're not talking about Southeast Michigan voters. We're talking about all across the state, so it is really a litmus test.
That's exactly right, if people across the state notice. For example, the three what are called constitutional universities, the U of M, MSU, and Wayne State, their boards of governors or boards of trustees are elected statewide. You have to wonder if somebody in the Western UP is thinking, why am I voting for the governor of Wayne State University? Most of them probably don't think about it at all. They either skip that race or vote a straight party ticket.
You think we ought to maybe change the way that's done? Should voters up in the Upper Peninsula be thinking about who might be on the Board of Governors at Wayne State?
Well, crazy as it sounds, I think this way is a good way. I think it's good because these are our three major research universities. People from all over the state go to all three of them. I, of course, am a professor and head of journalism at Wayne State, so I may have a little bias, but I attended both the other schools, so I'm fairly ecumenical. I think that because they take the largest share of taxpayer dollars, and it's not uncommon, I have a student right now from Houghton, I think it's fair for the voters, whether they pay attention or not, to have the right to sort of pass on who is in charge of these institutions. Other Michigan universities, like Western or Eastern or Central, their boards of governors are appointed by the governor, but not the three constitutional universities.
Back to the question of Board of Education president, who might we see running for the GOP?
Well, we don't know yet. We don't know yet because they will make that determination on August 27th at their state convention. It's likely that Tom McMillan is a very conservative former state representative, although on some issues he's made common cause with liberals on press freedom issues, First Amendment issues, things like that. I think he's likely to be a nominee, and there's a bunch of other folks who want that second slot. But again, if it's likely to be a Democratic year, Republicans are going to have an uphill push.
Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lesenberry. As always, thanks so much, Jack.
Always a pleasure.
Is the steam running out of the recovery from the Great Recession, at least from the perspective of local governments in our state? That's the question raised by a new report on the fiscal health of our local governments, the Michigan Public Policy Survey done by CLOSUP, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan. CLOSUP Administrator Tom Evacco is back with us. What were you asking local leaders?
We do an annual fiscal health tracking survey, and we ask local leaders whether their jurisdictions are better able or less able to meet their fiscal needs this year compared to last year. We ask a wide range of questions tracking fiscal health. That's kind of our summary question about changes. We also ask, what's their current status? Are they healthy? Are they in stress? And we asked about a lot of individual indicators as well.
And what stood out to you most about your most recent findings?
We think it's an early warning sign here that even though the economy in Michigan is still improving, maybe not, you know, gangbusters, but the economy's been improving for a while, including in the last year. But what we've seen this year in fiscal health for local governments is a reversal in a trend. What we've been tracking since 2010, each year there have been more and more jurisdictions saying we're better this year than we were last year. This year, that trend has reversed.
Why do we think this is happening?
Probably the most important source of funding for local governments in Michigan is property tax revenues. And what we've seen is a reversal in that trend. Mm-hmm. We've been tracking since 2010, each year more jurisdictions saying their property tax revenues have been increasing. This year, that has reversed. Fewer jurisdictions say their property tax revenues are going up. Same with state aid. We've been tracking the last few years. State aid has been increasing for more and more Michigan jurisdictions. This year, that trend has reversed. And costs continue to go up. Needs go up. It's a pretty complex set of issues that drive fiscal health for Michigan local governments. And there are warning signs in a lot of areas.
Well, what jumped out was local officials' confidence in being able to meet their fiscal needs is at 31%.
That's right.
Is that like a canary in the coal mine type of thing to you?
That's exactly what we think it is. This is kind of an early warning. And the worst thing here from our perspective is this is happening while the economy is continuing to improve. What we've seen is it takes an awful long time for a state as big and complex as Michigan. It takes a long time for fiscal health to improve for, you know, our wide range of community types and jurisdiction types. If we're already starting to see a reversal in these trends of things getting better while the economy is improving, that's a pretty big concern, I think.
Yet even as local leaders say they have shrinking confidence, your analysis says more than 40% plan to increase spending on infrastructure and more than 30% on public safety. So what's going on here? Is it because these expenditures are absolutely necessary?
Yeah, it's probably a few things. We ask about whether those needs are increasing, the demands for infrastructure maintenance, the demands that people place on them for public safety services. And those are at all-time highs as we track them. We started our survey in 2009. Infrastructure needs are at their highest level since we started tracking. Also, what we saw when the Great Recession hit back in 2008, 2009, we saw local governments trying to protect services. They made cuts in other places before they started to really cut into services. And so I think they're still kind of catching up in improving services, improving infrastructure.
I was really struck as you looked at fiscal stress and really high alarm at the county level with nearly 19%. That's like a fifth of county officials rating their fiscal stress as high. And a year ago, it was just 3%. That's a big jump.
That's a very big jump, especially as we tend to track just 1 year. That's a very significant increase. Again, a few things really stand out for counties. Property tax revenues. Last year when we asked, are your property tax revenues increasing or decreasing, only 5% of Michigan's biggest counties said that they were going down. This year, 27%. That's a very significant increase in a short period of time. State aid, 34% of Michigan counties say that their aid from the state is decreasing this year. Now, it's not huge cuts from the state, but nonetheless, less money from the state while their costs are still going up.
So if you're Governor Snyder and your state lawmakers, what should you take away from what you found from our local government leaders?
We are in the process right now of doing additional analysis on the data that we gathered from the survey, and we're coming out with a report in a few weeks that's going to look at the state's system of funding local government. We think what we see right now in this report we've released today is an early indicator there that this is something that's going to have to be dealt with. Again, if these kind of problems can start to happen while the economy is improving, what's going to happen when our next recession hits?
Tom Evacco with the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan. Tom, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Fighting disease in developing countries is really an uphill battle. One of the biggest challenges, lack of roads. How do you get clinical samples, blood, stool, from a remote village with no roads to a laboratory where those samples can be tested for disease? That critical problem is why there's so much promise in what a startup from Michigan has accomplished. They've used a drone on a life-saving medical mission in Madagascar. The company is called VIU, based in Ypsilanti. Julie Bateman is with VIU. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Tell us then, what was the big event on July 27th, just a few short weeks ago?
Sure. So July 27th was the first day that VIU transported clinical lab samples from a remote village about 15 kilometers away to a central laboratory. And this was done with Stony Brook University with a team of four medical students.
So this was totally self-driving. It was autonomous. There was nothing involved. It took samples from point A to point B.
Yes, correct. So what's challenging with the villages is they're all accessible by foot trails, not even roads, so not like a motorcycle that can access them. And so the medical students have been traveling with liquid nitrogen, with a generator, with a centrifuge to process the samples and then keep them at a constant cold temperature. And so what the drone enabled them to do is put the lab samples into the drone and transport them directly to the lab.
And what kind of diseases can this help fight? So the idea is get it to a lab and let the lab look at these samples and make diagnoses?
Yes, that's exactly it. For Madagascar, what we were focusing on this summer was tapeworm infection. And so a disease called cysticercosis. It's really high prevalence in remote areas. It can lead to neurocysticercosis, which is the leading cause of acquired epilepsy in these countries.
And I guess the idea being, if you can get in there and diagnose it early, you can treat if you know that that's what this patient has and keep it from getting worse?
Yep, exactly. And that's Madagascar. We're talking with a number of other organizations. There's interest for tuberculosis, for HIV diagnosis. And so there's a number of like bottlenecks within remote healthcare where rapid transport of lab samples can assist with diagnosis. And then, like you were saying, with treatment.
Now, tell us about this unmanned aerial vehicle, the UAV. I know people call it drones, and the technology isn't so brand new, right?
No. I mean, this is a technology that it's been around for decades, but it's new as far as it being commercially available and private companies being able to use it in the airspace.
And using for this medical purpose. How did you all connect all of this? You've only been around for 2 years.
We started with actually a former medical student at University of Michigan Medical School, Daniel Pepper. And he had worked for about a decade in India and the Middle East. And he worked at a rural clinic there. He saw the enormous challenges with getting basic medicines, with transporting lab samples, blood products to the remote areas. And the limitation was poor roads. So why not bypass the roads when we have this technology? And so we've been really focused on developing a drone that can meet these needs. And that's been kind of like the long path of development.
And so what have you got? Tell us about this drone and how far it can go and how much it can carry.
Yeah. So the drone itself, this is like the part that we always like to talk about. So what's important for what's available for drones are those quadcopters. And those are, it's like a body with four propellers on it. And those are great for taking off and landing vertically, like a helicopter. It's like the DJI Phantom. And those, while they're great for, you know, that action, they're limited in range. So they can go maximum maybe 20 kilometers. But what if you're trying to reach people that are farther away than 20 kilometers? And so what Vayu does is we combined that quadcopter with a fixed-wing aircraft. And so it still takes off and lands vertically like a helicopter, but we're able to reach about 60 kilometers, three times the range, and then still land in that clinic to, say, pick up lab samples.
And so I can imagine when you think about where this can go and what this could mean, this is a real game changer for public health in developing nations.
Yeah, once this becomes something that's reliable to use and authorized in the airspace, it's something that can access communities that previously were really difficult to reach, especially, you know, in areas where it's dirt roads and there might be, you know, heavy rains that come through.
Now, are there any flying restrictions at all in Madagascar that you had to deal with as you were setting this up?
Yes, absolutely. And so we're very fortunate that Stony Brook University has about three decades of working in Madagascar, and we needed to get permission from Ministry of Health, Ministry of Environment, Ministry of Defense, and then the Civil Aviation Authority.
You had a lot of hoops to jump through to make this happen.
Yeah, this would not be possible without an extremely good partner on the ground. It's a new technology, and there's a lot of questions for how to safely incorporate it into the airspace. And so understandably, most countries in the world have a similar type process where you receive special permission.
What kind of response have you seen both in the village, this remote village in Madagascar, but also from officials in Madagascar now that there has been a successful flight, samples were delivered, mission accomplished?
I think the most exciting was the reaction from the community itself. And I think the important step to take when we were doing these projects is there's a meeting with the community to say, you know, this is what's arriving, this is what it's going to look like, and this is what it'll be able to do. And so really when the drone landed, it was surprise and curiosity and excitement. And then as far as the like local officials, once they understood, you know, what could be done with the drone, I think they're very excited for what the future possibilities are. One of the big challenges that they're trying to address in Madagascar, which is one of the poorest countries, is tuberculosis. And if they can more readily transport samples, they can improve diagnosis, improve treatment.
And this really is something that could be used around the world and in this country, because there are certainly remote areas in this country as well. So it sounds like the possibilities are endless.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, how we see this drone being used by individuals in remote areas is anyone that can use a smartphone would be able to send and receive medical goods. And this part of the equation is really important for making it a cost-effective solution for delivering remote healthcare, that there won't need to be a technician or a specialized operator on the ground in order for somebody to use the UAV.
And is it expensive for the partners to be part of this?
So right now we're very fortunate that we receive USAID funding to pilot the technology to show how it can be used. And that's partially because we're still developing the mm-hmm. platform. The important thing is looking at what's the cost effectiveness of it. If a drone has a lifetime of 5 to 10 years and it's transporting for a few cents on the dollar each journey it takes, then those are the sort of things that add up for a rural healthcare system.
Now, the first flight was, as we said, July 27th. Have there been more? Will there be more? What's the plan to ramp this up?
Yeah, so there'll definitely be more. And it goes back to partially to the airspace regulations. And so we're working with a number of partners to plan pilot projects in areas that the Ministry of Health sees value in trying this technology.
Had to be exciting to have it work, have those samples delivered, diagnosis made, and knowing that that technology that VIU developed here in Ypsilanti in southeast Michigan made a difference to villagers in Madagascar.
The team was incredibly excited. I mean, our engineers have worked incredibly hard to develop this platform, to test it in Michigan, and for it to go and do something useful abroad. And that was the milestone that we were looking forward to all along.
Julie Bateman is with VIU, a drone developed by this Michigan startup, recently made the first fully autonomous flight carrying clinical lab samples from a remote village in Madagascar to a laboratory. Julie, congratulations on the successful flight, and here's to many, many more.
Great. Thank you.
Anyone driving between Detroit and Grosse Pointe will be struck by the stark change that happens when you cross Alter Road. That's the border. Now comes a report from a New Jersey nonprofit that declared the economic divide between Detroit schools and Grosse Pointe schools is the worst in the nation. The report from EdBuild, that's the group, is called Fault Lines, America's Most Segregating School District Borders. It says nearly half the households in Detroit's school district live in poverty. In Grosse Pointe, the number is 6.5%. EdBuild's report says the sharp economic divide goes back to 1974 to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling Milliken v. Bradley, and that ended busing between school districts to achieve racial integration. And it asks a question, why does there have to be that boundary between Detroit schools and Grosse Pointe schools? Grosse Pointe resident Greg Bowens founded the Grosse Pointe Harper Woods branch of the NAACP. He was press secretary to Detroit Mayor Dennis Archer, and he's with us now. Greg, what did you think of the EdBuild report?
I thought that, one, I was going to have the opportunity to discover something new in this report about, you know, the differences in funding between urban and school and then suburban school districts. But sadly, what I found was that the report itself was flawed. And ultimately, I came to the conclusion, based on the reading of the report and doing the background on the person, the CEO of EdBuild and their partners, that this is nothing more than a thinly veiled attempt to advance the charter school movement at the expense of African Americans. And the way they do it is by using stereotypes as a foil to get more money for the charter school movement. And I say that because you just talked about the numbers in relationship to poverty, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
First of all, when we talk urban, that's code word for black and poor. When we talk suburban, that's code word for rich and white. In the report, they never addressed the racial breakdowns of the school districts, and they ignored the migration patterns of black and brown people all across this country. I think that the reason they do that is because it gets more complicated when you start talking about race, and it's not they're not able to capture the nuances that we as black and brown people around the country engage in trying to get a good education for our children wherever we may live. In Grosse Pointe, for example, they talk about the poverty rate being 6%, but for whatever reason, they excluded Harper Woods. Harper Woods is almost 50% black, according to the latest, you know, census data, and half of those kids go to Grosse Pointe schools. The actual poverty rate for students attending Grosse Pointe schools for the student body is 17%.
Because you have to count the students that come from Harper Woods.
You have to count the students that come from Harper Woods. There is, and I'm sure that that has an impact, but there are people who live in affluent communities all across this region who are struggling with issues of poverty. They're just hidden behind, you know, the big houses that take, you know, our distraction. There are apartments, there are flats, there are, you know what I'm saying? Mm. There are different levels of living in all of these communities. And to leave out the 17% figure it to me is an abomination. I know why they do it, because it doesn't sound as good as 6%. The other thing that they leave out and don't talk about is the race of people. But they talk about attempts by the court to fix racial segregation. It was never about economics. It was about, you know, laws based on race. It's weird. It's like the Ed Build folks, they're doing a Donald Trump. They're talking to a room full of white people about what black people should be doing. But what in actuality, what they're trying to do is use civil rights and racial stereotypes as a wedge issue to knock down borders and free up more money for charter schools. I'm firmly convinced of that.
Let me ask you this, Greg, because you've got to admit, it's very hard to argue that there is not tremendous disparity as you cross Alter Road. I mean, if I was raising my family and I lived on Dickerson in Detroit, my kids aren't going to get the opportunities in the education they would if I was just a few blocks east on, let's say, Whittier in Grosse Pointe Park.
Sure, that's true. I'm not suggesting that that it is not true. But you know what? When we don't acknowledge race, we don't acknowledge migration patterns, we then fall into using the story of the past. This is not the Grosse Pointe of your great-grandfather or even your grandfather. The number of black and brown people that have moved into the area that are serviced by the school district is 10 times more than what it used to be then, whereas you could be the only person of color, black or Asian or Hispanic or whatever it was, attending one of the schools. That's simply not the case now. And you don't have to make the story worse than it is. So you want to say 6% poverty rate in Grosse Pointe as opposed to the true number, which is a 17% poverty rate among the students. And you do that because you want to make a greater point. For black and brown people who have moved to Grosse Pointe, who have moved to West Bloomfield, who have moved to Southfield in an effort to, you know, get a better education for their kids, and in an effort to provide a better sort of lifestyle for their kids, this kind of attempt by Ed Build undermines that when they ignore racial migration patterns. They want to hold up black people as the boogeyman and say that urban is poor and black and suburban is rich and white, but they don't want to address the issues of race. How do you talk about fixing a racial inequity without talking about race? And that's what these people do. They're not interested in helping poor black children or children from that particular perspective at all, because they don't say anything about race. And so, no, it's not always the same. The reason why it's hard for us as people of color to achieve economic parity is because of 300 years of discrimination. It's only been since 1965 that we've had affirmative action, and that's been curbed. And so the idea of being able to provide a pathway as education, being able to provide a pathway for upward mobility, is truncated in a lot of ways by these kinds of efforts. Black folks and brown folks take two steps forward and get to West Bloomfield or get to a Grosse Pointe or get to pick your place, Beverly Hills or whatever it is. And along comes folks who say, you know what, we need to do something about this. It seems unfair.
And as you did some research, what did you learn about the head of Ed Build?
Well, the head of Ed Build used to be the COO of Students First. Students First is a political organization that is committed to, under the auspices of education reform, essentially establishing more charter schools. I mean, that's what they're about. They're about getting at the public money to fund privately managed schools and call those public institutions. You know, look, I understand that we have to do what we can do to educate our children. But this report in Ed Build and what the way they looked at places around the country completely ignores charter schools. They're not discussed at all. It completely ignores the fact that today, Grosse Pointe and Detroit and Southfield and Farmington Hills are all competing across borders, sometimes with each other, but mainly with charter schools in another district or their own, online education as well, and homeschooling. All of these things cross district boundaries, and the money in Michigan follows the kids. And so that is another sort of glaring example of how the EdBuild report does not adequately reflect the realities of today. And they do it because that gets in the way of the narrative and it gets in the way of the stereotype that they're trying to do. I get so tired and frustrated as, you know, as an advocate for equal rights for everybody when we see institutions like this, you know, use the cover of civil rights and social justice as a foil to get what they really want, which is dismantling of the public school system that services everybody. There are not enough charter schools in this country or in this state to service all the kids that are out there. And given this lady's background as COO of Students First, as an architect of the charter school movement in Washington, D.C., and other places, it's just amazing to me that folks are not asking the right questions and they're accepting this narrative because it's what we're used to.
Greg Bowens, Grosse Pointe resident and the founder of the Grosse Pointe Harper Woods branch of the NAACP. Greg, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us and taking time to be on Stateside.
Thank you for having us, and I appreciate you paying attention to this important issue.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the most powerful images of the Flint water crisis was the photo on the cover of Time magazine of then 2-year-old Sincere Smith, his little face covered with a rash. His mother insisted the rash began when the water in the city changed to the Flint River, and it got better once the family moved out of Flint. The state of Michigan and the federal government have spent the past 6 months trying to figure out why so many people in Flint, like Sincere, reported rashes and hair loss. The report came out today. Michigan Radio Steve Carmody is here with us. Steve, there was a lot of heavy artillery brought in for this study, wasn't there?
Yes, there were. I mean, you had folks from the CDC who were involved in this, federal health officials involved in this, the EPA was involved in this study, and they brought in hundreds of people, looked at lots of rashes, and have a better sense of where people are getting their rashes now, although it's still unclear exactly where the problem began when the city was on the Flint River.
Okay, let's start with the current water. So people are still, even since the city switched last October, people are still reporting rashes, aren't they?
That's correct. About half the people who were in this study were people who say they developed the rashes since the October switchover from the Flint River back to the city of Detroit. And the experts today said that there's nothing unusual about the rashes that they're seeing now. They say about 3 out of 10 people will develop an eczema or skin irritation similar to what they've been seeing in Flint. They also say that part of the reason why people are still developing rashes could be the stress, the mental stress, the physical stress that people have had during the water crisis. And also, you have a large number of people who are still not bathing in a regular way, and that is a contributing factor for people developing rashes.
Now, what about the water from the Flint River that people were bathing in and drinking between April 2014 and October 2015? What does the report say about that?
Well, there's a bit of a difficulty for the people putting together the report. They've only started studying the rashes since the beginning of this year. So the rashes they were looking at were not necessarily ones that developed while the people were using the Flint River water, which ended in October. So what they had to do there was they focused more on the data that they had about what was the status of the water coming out of the Flint water plant during the 18 months the city was on the Flint River. So using that analysis alone, they tried to get a sense of what could have caused rashes. And they said that during that 18-month period, the city's water hardness was fluctuating a great deal. The pH level of the water was fluctuating a great deal. The chlorine levels in the water was fluctuating a great deal. And of course, then the chlorine-related disinfectant byproducts were fluctuating a great deal during that period. And they say there's a strong probability, not a certainty, but a strong probability that the rashes that people were developing were related to the water. But they can't say for sure that the rashes are related to the improperly treated Flint River water.
And then going back to today's water, they really couldn't, I'm hearing you saying, couldn't find any connection between what's coming out of taps now and rashes that people might be getting now.
Exactly. They said that right now the water is within the standards that are set by the federal government. And so the water should not be a source of problems. And another thing I did want to mention, certain metals that come in contact with skin do cause skin irritation. Ironically, lead is not among those metals. So just because someone's home may have a spike in their lead levels, that may not necessarily then translate directly to skin irritation, according to the experts, but other metals that might be present in their water may very well.
Steve, are people in Flint going to trust this report, do you think?
No. Very simply not, just simply because the level of trust in government and government reports is very low in Flint to begin with. So what they hear today, it's probably going to fall on a lot of deaf ears as people look around and say, listen, we still have problems here, and I don't trust that you're telling me the truth.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody, thanks so much for updating us on this latest report from Flint, Steve.
You're welcome.
Who can understand the problems, the fears and worries of veterans and military service members better than someone who has served? That's the idea behind Buddy to Buddy, the only program of its kind in Michigan, peer support, veterans helping other vets and service members. Stephanie Zarb is an Air Force veteran. She was deployed twice to Afghanistan and for counter-narcotics missions in South America. Now she's program manager for the Buddy to Buddy Volunteer Veteran Program. And one of the volunteers is here, Ron Springer. He's been with Buddy to Buddy since 2013. He served in the Army during the Vietnam War, a platoon leader in the 101st Airborne. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
How, Stephanie, has Buddy to Buddy evolved and changed? Because I know the program began in 2009, so with a few years under its belt, how has it changed?
Well, we were actually started as a program to serve the needs of Michigan's returning veterans who back in 2009 were our National Guard members, our National Guard and Reserve members. Most people maybe don't necessarily know this, but here we are a Guard and Reserve state, meaning that we have no active duty bases here in Michigan. Under the current conflicts, at sometimes during the current conflicts, more than 40% of all deployed troops have been our National Guard and reservists. But there wasn't exactly a great plan worked out for what to do when these folks were coming home. The folks at the University of Michigan got together with leadership at the Michigan Army National Guard and came up with this idea of Buddy to Buddy. And so for our first few years, we worked exclusively in Michigan National Guard armories working with those returning soldiers. But what we realized in those early years is that this program was really effective and really doing great things. So in 2013, we really opened it up to all service members and veterans, any era of service. You know, we started helping everybody. And today we actually do more work out in the community than we're doing in the armories, which has been kind of a big switch.
What's the actual mission? What are you sending these trained volunteer vets out to do?
To change the lives of Michigan's veterans for the better. It was sort of a mission that was born very much out of the Vietnam vet generation, knowing that as a nation, we really miserably failed our Vietnam veterans when they came home. And the effect of that failure continues to influence military families today. We wanted to try and make a difference and do something different and make sure it never happened again. We now have 130 trained volunteers throughout the state of Michigan, and their mission is to find veterans in their local community who could use any type of assistance at all. So it can be legal, it can be employment, mental health, it can be really anything, just to connect with those veterans, and if they need assistance, to make sure they're aware of the programs, the many, many programs here in Michigan that take care of all of our veterans, and get them connected and help them walk with them on that journey.
And again, having someone who's done it, and Ron, I'm going to turn to you as somebody from the Vietnam generation who has decided this is worth his time in volunteering. Why did you come to Buddy and say, yep, I'm going to volunteer?
I was at a military reunion of mine in Grand Rapids, and I saw a bunch of the soldiers going up to the mezzanine, and I went up there, and I saw the Buddy to Buddy group. I said, what do you do? And they told me what they did, and I said, I want to do that.
Why?
Because I wanted to help veterans. I was lucky coming home from Vietnam. I had a good support network, my parents. I got back into school, transferred to Michigan State, and I was lucky. It went kind of bing, bang, boom for me when I came home. But I know so many were not lucky. And with these soldiers, I came to see, and it became readily apparent within a short time, that there's a closer bond between the Iraq, Afghanistan military and the Vietnam vets than there ever was between the Vietnam vets and the older generation. I've met veterans that were going on their second tour, and I said, let me know if you need anything. And they'd let me know, and I'd send them things that they couldn't get, because there's always things that you can't get in a combat zone. One soldier's fiance said, why does he do this? And he said, because he understands, Noel. He understands.
Mm-hmm. Why is it so hard for veterans and military service members to kind of go, you know what, I'm in a jam and I need help?
We're actually trained not to. In a combat situation, you don't need a bunch of people saying, I have a headache, I can't come to work today. It just doesn't work that way. Really, since the dawn of humanity, we've been training our military folks to keep moving forward. And within the program, we talk about when you're in military training, we are trained that if we have a problem, we change our socks, we drink some water, we take some Motrin if it's really bad, and then we keep moving forward. And that's wonderful if you think about that mentality, and that's what it takes to fight these wars, and we have an amazing military force. The issue is when we come back from that military experience and try to be civilians again, that mindset is seen as aggressive and it's not very good at problem solving. There's really sort of no transition process. There is a transition assistance program, but it takes a lot longer than that. It's sort of like if you woke up in France tomorrow, you'd realize you're in a foreign country. You'd ask your neighbors for some help. You'd figure out how to pay bills. How do I get a job? This is a really different place. Well, when you get out of the military, you wake up in a foreign country, but you don't even know you're in one, really.
Yeah.
It takes, I think, another veteran who understands that, who can talk to you in that veteran language and understands that mindset to sort of help you baby step back into what it is to become a civilian again.
So you almost don't know what you don't know once you come back.
Right.
And you, Ron, actually go where they're training. My understanding is you will never ask someone, are you okay? Why is that?
Because you get a yes or no answer. We ask them, how are things going? How's things going with the family? So you get an answer that starts spilling the beans, if you will, and telling you, well, yeah, things are going okay. Well, okay, maybe, yeah, my wife lost her job last week, and one of our kids has got some issues. It's gradual. They just don't come out and just, I can't write that fast. No, it's very gradual.
So you have to be a good listener.
And that is one of the things we're taught, because mm-hmm. we all like to tell our war stories and stuff, but listening is the biggest part. And I'll give you an example of one soldier, a tough, big, burly, mm-hmm. tough soldier. His command said, Ron, you need to talk to him. And he knew that I was the buddy to buddy. Everybody knew who everybody was. The soldier, you know, during the training, he says, I'll come up, get with you later. And he says, let's go for a walk. And we walked outside, and I didn't say a word. We walked down the sidewalk, and this tough guy mm-hmm. said, this is really hard for me. I mean, just really hard for him to let somebody see inside. And we're not done yet. I think things are better with him, not due to my part, but they've equalized a little bit. But that's the basis of it. It's so hard for them to come out and say things.
And when they do come out and say things, what are the kinds of problems, Stephanie, that your volunteers are hearing?
It can be everything from finding homeless veterans, sometimes with children, and working with them for 3 and 4 years and working through all different resources to get them into education, sustainable jobs, housing, sort of the whole gamut. And then we have other things that are a little more interesting. We had somebody who called in who it was his lifelong dream to be a chemist in the state of Michigan. Well, I barely passed Gen Chem, so I wasn't the right person to help him. But we actually have a volunteer in our volunteer corps that's a retired chemist with the state. And so we paired him up. And you just never know what you're going to get. This is my 4th year with the program. And you'd think, you know, I'm not going to see anything new. But I see new things, new requests coming in every day. And to this date, we've never turned anyone away. We've always been able to find something to try and help move forward. The types of referrals we make, the number one referrals to service officers to look at benefits and that side. The number two referral that we make, though, is actually to other volunteers and personal networks to try and really problem solve with veterans and help them find a way to improve their quality of life.
And I know, Stephanie, your own story here, you've been on 2 tours of duty for Operation Enduring Freedom, and you had a master's degree, and you came out and could only come up with a minimum wage job.
I was working part-time at a pain clinic for minimum wage, and I'd been out for about 6 months. I tell the story not because it's uncommon, but because
right.
it's very common, but also because I'm representative of the veteran population in the sense that I was fairly highly educated, had management experience, but just couldn't translate that. I just didn't know how to find a job. I didn't know how to translate what I'd done in the military, and it was very hard to find somebody that was willing to take a chance. I got very lucky. I got a phone call from my friend of mine who said, do you want to come train Turkish military officers for Boeing? And I said, absolutely. So I headed out to Seattle and I did that for a year. But what I didn't know was most of the people that work for Boeing Defense are veterans. And so when I got there, they said, well, you're eligible for VA health care. Why are you paying for health care out of pocket? Which at the time, you know, mm-hmm. I was paying for this catastrophic insurance plan that was very expensive. You're eligible for all these different benefits. You know, we can get your migraine service connect, all these different things. I had no idea. And it was wonderful for me. But then I was thinking, well, why isn't somebody doing something? Why isn't somebody helping with this? And of course, I stumbled across the Buddy to Buddy program at the University of Michigan and just had to get involved. I started there in 2013, and they haven't been able to get rid of me yet.
How many total have you reached, do you think?
It's almost impossible to say for sure, because usually, and this is great if you have kids, it's a great way to embarrass them. If I'm out for dinner and I see a veteran hat, I'm going to stop and talk to that person, and I might help them on the spot, and I don't go back and record it as I'm supposed to. And I'm the program manager, so you can imagine how that multiplies, right, by all the volunteers. To date, on paper, we can show how we've worked with well over 3,000 service members and veterans. Typically, the ones that get logged are the more complicated and involved situations where we have multiple people working on them and we follow them for years. Unofficially, I'd say the number's easily twice that.
What do you each, and I'm going to start with you, Ron, what do you want to say to any service members, veterans, or family members who are listening to us talk right now?
That if they have an issue that is in the formative stages or in any stage, but especially if you can catch something early, to contact buddytobuddy.org, because sometimes, as with anything we learned in life, and I think most of us were told by our parents at an early age, if you'd come to me earlier with this, it would have been easier. Come to us and let us take a shot at seeing what, if we can help, because it's totally confidential. And that's a big foundation of the program. We don't talk with officers, NCOs, family members, really nobody, and mention a name. It's totally confidential. And we can, there's probably nothing, as Stephanie said, that we haven't seen. Yeah. Virtually nothing. And we can help. So give us a try.
It has to feel good for you 45 years later that here you are able to do what you wanted to do for today's military members.
Well, a former supervisor of mine said when I retired from the planning department, he says, now you can go out and do something you had a passion for. Unfortunately, I don't get paid, but I have a passion. And when the soldiers get to know you, as staff told us, it'll take, depending on the unit and your interaction and everything, it could take 3, 4, 5 months. But when they get to know you and when you go out to the field with them at Grayling and one of the soldiers says, Ron's here, talk with Ron if you got any things you need to talk about. That's when you know you're part of them. And you start to feel just a little bit younger until I look in the mirror.
And Stephanie, what do you want to say to any service members, any veterans who are listening?
You're not alone. You know, it feels very lonely to be a veteran, and I don't care if you came back 45 years ago or if you came back yesterday. It's very lonely. If you reach out to us, you don't have to ask for help. We'll just sit down and talk to you. We'll listen to what you have to say. We'll try to identify what red flags, what resources might be out there. So this isn't a call saying I need help. This could just be a call. Talk to another veteran who's been there. You may not even know that you're eligible for things that are out there. You're not alone. Please give us a call.
Tell me your most significant case, the one that really sticks in your heart, Ron.
It comes about as part of life experiences. I left the city at one point and took a private sector job, and management went in a different direction, and I was laid off a year and a half later. But I didn't burn a bridge. I mean, one of the fellows there was mad that I was getting laid off. And so I bounced, and I found some jobs. And then that fellow later became the manager, and now this he has his own company, which leads me to this issue where I was told that a couple with three kids, he had just had job issues. Their one car with 200,000 miles got a new transmission through the Veterans Trust Fund, and then the other car died on the highway. And they were in dire straits, lived out of town, 30 miles in the country. And so I started trying to think who would maybe give me a deal on a car, which we all know doesn't happen too much. But I asked my friend, who owns his own company now, if he knew any car dealers, and he asked me why. And I said, because I got to get a car for this family. And he said, where do you usually go? And I said, well, Wounded Warriors sometimes has some, but they're in southeast Michigan, and it'll take some time. And he said, well, what do you pay for them? And I said, well, they find that they have to spend about $7,500 for a decent used vehicle. 20 minutes later, I get an email from my friend, says, what if I buy two? And so I called the family back. I said to the wife, are you sitting down? She goes, no, why? Is there more bad news? And I said, no, actually, we've got a car for you, but we just don't know what it is yet. So that was a combination of not burning a bridge, of staying in touch with people. You never know where people are going to end up. And this person said their mission statement for their company was to help veterans. So, I mean, I look like a hero, and it was strictly just coming together.
Connecting. Well, you can find more information on the Buddy to Buddy program by going to buddytobuddy.org. You can find them on Facebook, or you can call 888-82-BUDDY. That's 888-82-BUDDY. Ron Springer and Stephanie Zarb with Buddy to Buddy, thank you so much for your service, each of you, and thank you for what you do for our veterans and for our service members.
Thank you for your support, and thank you so much for having us.